Do you have a current bio that you're happy with? A short little thing?
No, not really. I go with just the name, you know, that I founded the press with Gary and that I really like books. Spent a lot of time reading, writing, designing, typesetting.
Very good.
Marketing, selling books.
Yeah, so the only difference between us is you actually do something about it. I just like to talk about it.
I don't know. I would say you're several steps better than just talking about it.
Well, I do like to buy them, too. I love to collect them. You're right. Okay, so welcome, Andrew, again to the Bibliophile.
Yeah, thanks, Nigel.
It's been about a dozen years, so it's a good time to check in.
You can see on the floor, you would have sat on this side of the wall
last time,
and now you can see where the paint line, where the wall came down.
Right. And now I'm looking at all sorts of lovely silvery...
Those are shavings from the back of linotype slugs, Glenn Galuska's linotype, which now lives here, arm's length from my desk. So I figured if I put it that close to my desk, I was going to use it more frequently than if I tucked it in the back of the shop somewhere.
It's a beautiful looking machine too. You got it nice and oiled up too.
Oh, it's necessary to keep them clean. The dust is the enemy of a linotype machine. It's good at running. So yeah, they're gorgeous, complicated. It's like if watches did not have cases and you just looked at the watch guts and all the time. It's what the linotype is. It's just a lot of moving parts.
Do you collect anything around linotype, like manuals and stuff?
I do try to collect like specimens and manuals, and their German and English ones are different, and British and America is different, and matrices, of course, to run on them the different typefaces. So it's very much a working collection. I don't run off over looking for obscurities that I won't use or don't love. I would say maybe a third of my collection came from Glenn. So they're things that he would have collected through the 80s and 90s and out of Toronto and Montreal. And some came out of a shop in North Carolina and some I've just bought here and there, either from people like Don Black or other private individuals, who had different typefaces for the machine. So
now when we talked
12 years ago.
Yeah. We concluded with, and I think I was talking a little faster back then.
We probably both were.
So the interviews are a bit longer now.
They're leisurely.
Yes, yes.
More room for the listener.
Your advice to your children was to pay attention, to care, to create, to make things. I just wonder if that still stands.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. And they're all now, in their 20s. My oldest son just got married. My daughter has had and her partner have had a child. My youngest boy is in university, so they're all edging into adulthood and finding their way. And it's delightful to see that they are doing those things in their way. I'd forgotten that interview ended on that note. My memory, of course, of that interview is that we just talked about The Sentimentalist, which I was sick of talking about.
Right, right. Well, and I think I made the large claim that it would be one of the great books to go after for Canadian collectors because of all of the controversy and stories around it. So,
You may yet be proven.
I may yet, yeah. I know that it's very difficult to find the first printing of that for sure.
Yeah.
And it did win the Giller and the Alcuin Award. So, it's got the design award. Okay, so we've established the fact that paying attention, and that, what exactly does that mean? Paying attention?
Well, being interested in inhabiting your own life, I think, largely. I mean, our world is so full of ways of distracting ourselves from, the day-to-day, from our own environment. You can go for a run And you put in the earbuds and suddenly you're in a Nashville studio listening to someone. You're not in the space that you're in. And so paying attention, I think, is first and foremost starts there by just being present in your own environment and with the people around you and investing and caring in them.
Yeah, I find that I have difficulty because I'm always thinking of stuff. So I'm always off in some idea rather than...
Well, that's okay. That's still being, you know, a way of paying attention, a way of being present. I mean, it's still rooted in your life, right?
It is, but it means that I forget my keys quite often.
Oh, well, that's a whole other matter. but you know, it also extends outwards into being aware of and alert to the people around you in your community and what your community's needs are, being invested in the goings-on and wanting to be a part of those things.
Mm-hmm.
It's a piece of advice I often give younger writers, you know, when they come in. People are not always younger, but new writers. People are starting to think about how do you do this trick. And, you know, you can't write if you're not living, if you're not invested in your day-to-day and the people around you.
In the details.
That's right. That is the minutiae is what we're built out of. We're tiny little atoms bouncing around, you know, a lot of water molecules. Like, it's all about the details.
Well, and also in any kind of conversation that I conduct, what's interesting is the details.
But it's also, you know, the neglect of the details is what allows great indifference and injustice, ultimately. If you're not thinking about what it's like to be the person standing beside you, then you can treat them less somehow. If you can't tell the difference between a birch tree and a maple tree, then you probably don't care whether they get cut down. So paying attention has this, it's a piece of universal advice, you know. Like when my kids were small and I would take other people's kids with me canoeing and you'd take maybe one of the parents. The other parents were always a pain in the ass because they would want to make a lot of rules, you know, so the kids don't do that, you know. And so I would always try to shut it down right away by declaring with great theater to the other children, there's only two rules when you're canoeing with me. One rule is respect, which covers a lot of things, you know, whether you leave the stick in the fire or you wave it in the air, whether you play with a knife or you don't, whether you, you know, respect covers a lot of ground. Basically, it's another way of saying pay attention. But the second rule was no drowning, for comic relief, of course, you know. but you know, it's this universal piece of advice, I think, that so much would fix so much if we would just have empathy, if we would just pay attention, if we would invest of ourselves, inhabit our own lives, and a lot of this nonsense that we deal with would not happen.
Respect is at the base of any kind of relationship.
Yeah, because it's an acknowledgement of our responsibility to one another,
mm-hmm.
which is what all communities hinge upon, is that, you know, not, you know, right now, in these post-pandemic or near post-pandemic times, I mean, with a lot of talk of freedom and people's rights being curtailed, you know, people being upset about that. But everyone wants to talk about rights and no one wants to talk about responsibilities to each other. And, you know, and these things are always in balance. Mm-hmm. They just sort of don't exist without the other. One doesn't exist without the other.
Okay. Speaking about one thing relying upon another, in publishing, there is selecting the right text, a good text, and then there is presenting it.
Mm.
I want to dwell on the presenting it, but I do want to touch on selecting the right text. And before we started taping, we talked about...
It's my dad's clock.
Lovely.
My late father, yeah.
Yeah, let's listen to that. We're on the half hour there, are we?
I think it's on the quarter.
Oh, that's the quarter?
We'll
okay.
mark the interview.
Six or seven of those later.
That's right.
We talked about wanting to keep reading. Mm. That's the criteria that I use as a reader. It used to be after 50 pages. Now it's more like 5 pages.
Mm-hmm.
Is that what you use as a criteria?
It's certainly one of the criteria, and I think the one that everything hinges on ultimately is, you know, if I don't care, why would I expect anyone else to care, or why would I invest in this work?
Yeah. And you invest more than most because of the nature of your publishing firm.
From a personal standpoint, I think that's true. I mean, you know, there's often a division between selecting the work and then presenting the work, as you describe it. And here that, you know, I think in a lot of smaller firms, but in particular in a firm like ours, that line disappears, you know, ultimately. You know, whereas in our case, the person who is selecting the work, me, is also the person who is, you know, designing the work, editing the work before that, and doing some portion of printing and binding of the work often in concert with the other players here at the press. So, yes, you're very much invested. You know, I like to talk about publishing, like the kind of publishing I do is publishing with a capital P. But there's lots of other ways to do publishing that don't have the heart that this does, or doesn't have the same mission or mandate that this does, or
the work,
or the, well, for that too. Yeah. So it is possible, I think, to break those things up and to be calculating, and you hope that somebody in that chain of tasks, you know, has some love for the work beyond the kind of, you know, well, boxing books are hot right now, or
right,
whatever.
Right. Wrestling books
are hot. Right.
That was for you, Jack.
That was definitely for, we were both thinking about Jack.
Yeah.
David,
yeah,
so. But in a smaller enterprise like this, you know, where these things are of a piece and you are making books, you know, because it gives you pleasure to do so, but also because you believe in the kind of thing, the kind of tool that a book is in a community, and what thing it can do in a culture, you know, how it can shepherd ideas through time, how it can sort of sit quietly and wait like an improvised explosive device, you know, like,
yeah,
you know, all of these kinds of things that a book can do, that all so many of the other very nifty and useful gadgets we have now don't do as well. I mean, they do other things well, but they don't do that as well. If you are invested in those things and you think they have a value and are part of what makes your community healthy, then you really do take seriously that responsibility of being moved by what you're reading and what you're deciding to publish, of actually caring about it. I would say that probably one of the most common lines that I write in rejection letters when trying to explain, when I'm writing letters back to authors about books I'm not going to take, I'm often making a comparison and simply explaining, it's not my job to decide what books are good and not good, ultimately. I mean, as a reader, I'm welcome to do that, but as a publisher, it's not really my job. My job is to pick a dozen good books to publish next year that fit our program, that I can serve well, and that I think will serve the community well. So in explaining to an author that I'm not taking the
books. You just said good books.
Did I?
Yes.
Okay. There's this sort of faux pressure to have the book, right?
Okay.
You know, the winner for this, the best book.
Well, your version, I mean, it's subjective. That's what we're saying.
Well, there's always some subjectivity, absolutely. But there is objectivity, I think, also possible in assessing things that have merit or not merit,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
There is better and worse oatmeal, Nigel. It's not all subjective.
Yeah.
And no amount of maple syrup will make bad oatmeal good oatmeal.
Well, no, I would say that there's oatmeal that more people think is good than people think is bad.
That's okay. Marketing.
That is marketing, but again, the designation of best is subjective.
In a context of objectivity. Yeah, like these things are yin and yang in the thing. I always get cagey whenever anyone tries to paint anything in the arts as completely subjective. It's not that simple. I mean, there are at the end of the day, we all choose what we wish to spend our time on, and what we choose to value. But there are objective measures of form and of structure, and of humor to some extent even. I mean, like, all of these kinds of things, there are ways to look and sort of dissect and say, here's why this is a stronger made thing, or, you know, than this made thing. So I get cagey when we try to take that utterly out and just make it all subjective.
Yeah. Well, it's like someone who has expertise, someone who has read this kind of book all their life, And they say this is the best of that
yeah.
grouping. And someone who hasn't read anything but knows what they like and what they don't like.
And those are useful, you know, things to try to understand, like to try to understand one's subjectivity and try to master one's objectivity. But at the end of the day, all readers are simply responding, you know, and they may not all respond to the objectively best thing. They may respond to the thing that reminds them of their grandfather or of their yeah. of a dog they loved or whatever it is. You know, like I'm mm-hmm. not, it's not always sentimental, but, you know, they really like red cars. You know, like it's yeah. it's nothing about red that's special. It's just they like the red cars. Mm-hmm. So there is always that element. But cycling back to where I started before we wandered into this was the line that I often write is one of this work simply didn't excite me as much as others that were offered, or didn't interest me as much as others that were offered. That's a very honest and yet still kind of a broad and general line, but it's absolutely the truth. I mean, I see hundreds of books that could be published every year,
mm-hmm.
and I pick 12. I long ago decided to take the pressure off myself of picking the right 12 and decided to pick the 12 that interested me.
And hopefully those 12 will keep you in oatmeal.
Yes, and maple syrup, if I'm lucky. Yeah, okay. So this, when you said, asked whether it was this was a you know, criteria, like that you kept reading, that it drew you in. The other criteria are, usually there are three general criteria that I'm thinking about. One is that, do I care about this book? Do I love this book? Does this book move me? Another one is, can I sell it? You know, yeah, like, yeah. right? Like, that's ultimately what we do. I don't make books to store. I make books to go out there and make trouble in the world. So can I find an audience for this book? Which is, I think, an important question. But I'm also trying to understand whether the author and their text are a fit here. Whether the thing that we do and the way that we do it will be a good home for that author and what they need in this book and what it needs.
So what's that criteria then?
Well, are they someone who understands the scale that we're interested in, the way that we work? It's no good coming here and having us sign your book and to believe that we're going to behave, you know, and it's not just about economics or size, but that we're going to behave in the way that, say, you know, Random House will behave. That we're going to pursue the same things, the same goals. You know, ultimately, we all want to sell books to the right readers. I'm not sure that Random House cares about whether it's the right reader. I think that they're just interested in selling to readers, yeah, any readers, yeah. You know, they're just whoever.
Profit.
So it's a kind of shotgun approach where we're much more sharpshooters, I think, in some ways. So that's what I mean by that, there are books that don't belong. And a more obvious level is somebody who's written, you know, the memoir of their grandfather in the Cameron Highlanders regiments, you know, they're going to do better having that book privately printed and selling it at the farmer's market. They're going to make more money. They're going to find the right audience. They know that audience. They don't need us. They don't need us in that mix.
Mm-hmm.
And we may give them the best advice we can give them. We may even offer to do printing for them. But as a publisher, they don't need us. On the other end, someone that comes to me with the celebrity Train Your Dog book could sell millions. But it's not going to be the right thing here. It's not.
So what's the right thing?
We're largely publishing poetry and fiction and nonfiction, you know, in a literary vein here. That's a very general answer, I realize. But so we're working in that broader Canadian tradition of small presses. But I have a particular interest in, you know, when I've sort of tried to figure out what the organizing principle is of nearly 25 years of publishing here. It's back to that paying attention thing. It's back to I'm interested in people who are able to talk, able to write and communicate about the experience of being in a community. That's not to say my community here, but you know, succinctly and in an interesting way, in a way that kind of builds up challenges. These are things that interest me. So not placing the kind of
But
ultimately, most of the, when I look at the books, a strong element in the majority of them would be a strong sense of place and a strong sense of community, whichever place or community that happens to be.
Right.
because I think that that location of oneself, that understanding, you know, sometimes working with or working against the realities of that place, is you know, an essential part of that paying attention that I'm so interested in.
Okay. So it's easy to pay attention to the look of your books because because they are so damn, not just beautiful, they do all the right things in terms of presentation. So maybe that's where we should start.
Well,
are the right things?
Well, I think that that's, I'm happy that you've expressed it that way. Most people stop at saying they're beautiful, which is a kind of shortcut. And but actually what they are is they have the kind of fitness to purpose. You know, what I've always tried to do, I think of someone like the folk singer Gillian Welsh. I don't know that you know her music, but she has spent her career writing songs that sound like they came out of the Appalachian, that they had just have always been and could not be otherwise. And when I'm trying to design a book, I have the advantage of having edited the book, so I know it intimately. And I'm always trying to make it seem like it could just be no other way. And not, you know, brash or loud, though sometimes that is the right thing. We have dabbled there. But
loud is great.
Loud can be a lot of fun. Yeah. But most of the time, your job is to be out of the way and to simply make it seem like this has always been and could be no other way. You know, that rightness is that you're sensing is that a career of pursuing that kind of sensibility.
Okay. So book design, one definition, is the art of incorporating the content, style, format, design, and sequence of the various components and elements of a book into a coherent unit.
I mean, that sounds good, but I'd hate to eat food made by someone making food that way, wouldn't you? I mean, like that leaves out love, doesn't it? It leaves out curiosity. It leaves out impishness. What it does, a nod to, is that kind of, again, paying attention, that intimacy with the material and a sense of how to weave things together so that they don't fight you. And, you know, so many of our books now fight us on the most basic level. You grab a paperback and you open it and it fights you to open it because the publisher didn't ask the printer or the printer didn't care, you know, to get the grain of the paper the right way.
Yeah.
It's a very fundamental basic thing, but it's like, you know, using sugar instead of baking soda in a recipe. Like it'll screw it up if you don't do it right.
Well, the second sentence in this this little phrase here is that book design relies upon methods and rules which have been developed over centuries.
Yeah. So I am very rooted in sort of a classic book design approach, which isn't to say that all my books are sort of stodgy state and look like Oxford University Press in the 20s or something. But it means that I've steeped myself in this long tradition of making a page look right and flow right and behave right and do the job it's supposed to do.
So what's right?
And, well, you know, it's like asking how deep is a hole? I mean, you know, like, it depends what you're digging for, you know,
yes,
what you're doing,
yes,
you know.
Yes. What's right is what's right for that particular
you
content?
To, that's
is that
right.
It?
Well, so there's, you know, some general things about the materials. Like, you can use better and worse materials. You want paper that, you know, isn't too stiff and takes ink well and preferably has a little roughness to it so that it diffuses the light that bounces back at your eyes. And you want an ink that's black but not glossy, you know. And so there's right in that sense, on the technical side of some things. But as far as the layout of a book in terms of its size and the type that you choose, and I mean, that's going to shift from thing to thing to some extent as you are trying to evoke an atmosphere or make easy something that the author has made complicated in a, say, more technical book, which has much apparatus or something, and you're trying to make it navigable, make it, you know, a friction-free experience. You know,
understandable.
You know, so that when you think, I wish I knew what, oh, wait, there it is. They thought of that already.
So
those are what's right, you know, is serving the reader is what's right. And so for me, those things are coming out of largely 18th and 19th century, and earlier too, I suppose, influences, and coming out of the letterpress world. I mean, I simultaneously learned to design books in the digital realm and in the letterpress realm. And so those, I don't have a big, there's not a hard curb there for me, you know. So, and they both have, one tool has influenced the other. But because I'm like involved physically in the making of books, I have an advantage over so many graphic designers, you know, who really don't have a handle on what thing is going to, so they spend a long time often making mistakes and hopefully correcting, but maybe not, you know, where they send something off to the printer, comes back and it wasn't quite satisfactory and they don't really know why, because they weren't involved in the physical making of it. Yeah. That can be a real detriment to learning if you're not, it's not insurmountable. You can jump and come around it. You know, you can go ask the questions, right?
How do you decide whether the book is going to be a hardcover or a soft paperback?
Well, for us, that's pretty straightforward. We don't do a lot of hardcovers. But mostly when we're doing trade case binding, the few instances that we have, we'll send them out somewhere else. And we don't like sending things out, so I mostly avoid it. So most of our trade books are paperback, sewn paperbacks. For my limited edition. Well, that's the equipment I own. Decision made.
That's decision.
Yes. Well, and I control that process.
Right.
And
and
it keeps the price.
No, you could buy something.
And the price point is economical. Well, we looked at, you know, we dabbled with making short runs of hardcovers for a while in the early 2000s. And we were making a basic square back case in-house, and they were all done by hand. And we found that there wasn't really a serious market for it. There were some people that really liked having them, but the demand wasn't really there. And the cost and labor was really high for what we could then ask for the in return.
Yeah.
And we brought them out simultaneously generally with the paperbacks. And I just didn't like having two editions of things, really. Mm-hmm. I mean, but so it was an interesting experiment. I'm glad we tried it. But the next leap would be to, you know, expand the building, put in a case line. And again, I don't think that there's enough of a demand for hardcover books for the kinds of books we're doing, books, poetry, and so on. So we've not pursued that. We make really, really nice sewn paperbacks with a jacket, you know, which we price, you know, partway between a cheap paperback and a hardcover. But I am making hardcovers for limited edition books, and I'm doing it in-house myself because the scale is right. I mean, most of those runs are less than 100, more, you know, 20 to 100 is the range. And I can reasonably do that level of binding and get the binding I want in the way that I want and at a cost I can afford because I can spread the work out. And so in that case, because there are, we're charging more for those books.
Yeah,
we're starting to do slip cases and so on. So those are letterpress printed books too. They're not they're not offset printed books.
And this is
so
because of your equipment from Galushka primarily?
The binding, no, not so much. No, that's just something I've finally gotten around to.
And you love doing it?
I do, actually. Yeah. I really like
it. More than?
As much as.
Okay.
It's an integrated process. So right. I get grumpy if I do too much of one for too long. So I tend to have about three or four letterpress projects in a go. So I'm editing one and I'm typesetting or casting, you know, another. And then I'm printing another. And then I have another one at the binding stage. Mm-hmm. And so that way you can kind of, if you get frustrated, you just walk to the next table.
Yeah. Yeah,
and on top of that is of course the 12 trade books that we're doing every year, so it's a recipe for to ward off boredom and the malaise of middle age, I guess. I don't know. I mean, I just always have a lot on the go.
Well, the soft cover books that you do publish, because they're sewn, and because they have jackets, they do assume this lovely, special desirability. Mm. It's as if you're trying to get the best of both worlds here.
Absolutely, yeah. And they're robust. I mean, in terms of how they stand up.
Yeah.
And you know, there are more robust books than I would say. I shouldn't put a number on, I guess, but like there is a large number of trade hardcovers now that are simply perfect bound in a cheap case.
Yeah.
My books are more robust than that. Mm-hmm. So whether it has a hard case on it or not, it's still a stronger book.
Yeah. And going to last
yeah.
hundreds of years. Okay, moving along to the dust jacket. The spine is very important.
Well, a book needs one. Well, in what way do you mean? Like design
what I
wise?
Mean is it assumes more importance because of the way that it's presented
sure.
in a bookstore.
Yep, yeah.
And so that's how true, do you deal with the spine?
Mostly by ignoring that truth. I have actually had a lot of fun over the years. You know, one of the advantages of working for myself, you know, Gary and I with our own little enterprise, and mm-hmm. Is that there's no committee to answer to.
Right.
If I can convince the author it's a good idea, we're fine. And so a lot of the design awards we won back before I retired from design awards, you know, we won them, I think, in part because I was unfettered. Like, I just was able to play and to try things. And so I very often will do things on spines that work against this truth and will not display necessarily, well, the front as well, the whole of anything, that you kind of have to pick up and handle the book maybe to see exactly what you're looking at, because it bleeds over the edge of a spine or it bleeds off the edge of a cover.
But often it is the thing that will attract someone's or should attract their attention to the point that they will pull it out and look at the rest.
Right. Yeah, no, it's not completely an innocent. It is a flirtation for sure.
Yeah. But you don't have to have necessarily the author, the title, the publisher, and your logo, even though you do put your G on pretty well all of them.
No,
right?
I haven't used that G in a long, long time. We had a logo early on, and I kind of was very resistant to having a logo. Mm-hmm. So we'll just put the name, we'll spell the name of the press out in the spine often, or sometimes okay. we'll stack up the letters of Gaspereau 3/3, you know.
Yeah.
But I kind of follow each project and see what opportunities present itself. If it's a really skinny spine, as a lot of our poetry books will be, there's not a lot of real estate to do much there other than run the text. And if you have a bigger spine, you can, you know, design is so much about opportunism, right? Mm-hmm. That you because you're paying attention, you recognize opportunities with the materials that will allow them to be presented in a playful way or in a unique way. And it's staying alert to that and not just following the same old standard yeah. format.
Treating it like an individual.
Yeah, being present with it. You know, not phoning it in.
Yeah, it's just that this makes...
It's curiosity, Nigel. It's all about curiosity.
Right.
If you're not having fun, then...
There's two things. There's curiosity and there's enthusiasm.
Sure. Curiosity is just like pointed enthusiasm, is it not?
Yeah, I guess it keeps you thinking. It does keep you thinking.
Curiosity goes better with enthusiasm.
Yes, exactly.
Because then it becomes
or vice versa.
It becomes mirthful.
Yeah, which is exactly what you want in a good book.
I think so, yeah.
It's some good laughs.
Yeah, unless its job is to remind you of some great tragedy, which also
right.
is a legitimate literary form. But even there, you want to be encounter a freshness and a strangeness, right?
You want some enthusiasm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, this question might fall flat, but what rules do you follow when designing the cover? I know there are no rules. It's you follow the individual book, but there must be something that you do to make your covers look so good.
Oh, I mean, the main rule is the boring one, which is honor the text. You know, like
right.
it's not about me. Like it's not about a place for me to show off. You know, an idea that the author doesn't like is not a good idea. Like no matter how good an idea actually is, it's not a good idea. So
what do you mean? You have to.
Well, if I
you
can't,
have to, you have to get the approval of the author on your cover.
Contractually,
before you go
I don't.
Ahead?
But ethically, I do, because what good is having a book out there that an author is unhappy with?
Okay, give me an example of a book that you read. And then you came up with a great idea for a cover for it and that you're really happy with.
Sure.
And how that worked.
We just did a book with a poet named Sean Howard in Cape Breton. I'm blanking on the name, but anyway, but it has to do with the.
You're not a very good salesman.
No, no. This is the problem with working. You know, you're always working with the 40 books you just published, right. And the 10 you're working on, and the 10 next to come.
Yeah.
I've gotten really good at taking notes.
Yeah.
Because it's too much, and then the letterpress stuff, and then the world all around you. So yeah, it's too much. But
you're paying too much attention.
Yeah, that's right. anyway, it's a series of poems about 9/11, about the tragedy of that event. The poems were written but not published at the time, the year of the event. And then there's a section that follows that was more recent, looking back on the event. Mm. And so Sean's poems in this book they're very short. They're lines, 2-3 words, 4 words maybe maximum. So they're these long, skinny poems. And as I'm starting to read the book and I'm thinking about it and thinking about the title and his name, the title is something like Unrecovered. And it occurs to me that I will make it a skinnier book than normal, and that I will set on the jacket the two towers.
Yeah.
In the name of the title and the name of the author, and that the top.
I mean, they'll be the name. They're running side.
They're running. That's right. They've
down the tower.
45 or 90 degrees.
Yeah.
And they're running down. Okay. Is it like the two towers?
Yeah.
And that the tail end of the name and the title, which would be at the top of the book, will start to come apart. That they'll come out of their lineation. They'll start going sideways and left and right. They're coming down, and so in doing that, evoke the tower is being struck by the planes. That concept...
It's literal.
It's more than usual. Like, this was a particular opportunity, and this is why I talked earlier about the opportunism of design.
Yeah.
That to see that, you know, and the title was the right... It wasn't like an 8-word title. You know, his name, Sean Howard, was just... it matched. Like, it's an idea you'd have to abandon if the facts of the book did not line up. Like the facts of the object of the book. But because these things lined up, and as I'm editing and I'm thinking these things, this comes to me. You know, I close that window, I open another window, and I start to dummy this as I'm editing the book. And it works.
You got a copy?
And that's what I did. Yeah, I'll show you. Yeah. I'll show you when we're done. Yeah. And there it is. So sometimes it works that way.
Yeah.
And other times you're really, it's quieter. It's less high concept. It's more that you're simply finding the right scale at which to present the title and the author's name with a color of paper, you know, with a color of ink that feels right in its place. Okay. And that's a more common for, like, Faber was always that sort of, you know, that text driven. There's not a lot of pyrotechnics. It's not high concept. It's just clean. And so a lot of our design goes that way as well. But I'm alert to, you know, looking for other opportunities when it suits what the book is trying to do.
Okay. Anything else on covers or flaps or spines or whatever?
I think the most disappointing thing about jackets and covers is usually the text. You know, you look out there in the big world of publishing.
Yeah.
And so usually, you know, the writing of blurbs has been handed off. Either the author has contributed something and they've tweaked it, or they've handed it off to an intern, you know, to try and find something to say. And they're usually nonsense. I mean, they don't.
Or bullshit from another author or whatever.
Sure, sure. And often very loving and careful and well-intended. Yes. Bullshit, you know. But nonetheless, like, I love Don MacKay to death, but I never read Don MacKay's blurbs on the back of anybody's poetry book, because he's written hundreds of them for everybody. And it's just that
it's devalued.
It's devalued it in a way. And he, again... means the best. Was trying
yes.
to going it's, to bat for
it's
young
friendship.
Writer. Right,
yes.
Right. There's love in it, but it's difficult to do honestly and well in a way that actually helps the reader. So I put a lot of time into our blurbs are terse. There's almost never a something from another author or the New York Times or whatever. There's none of that kind of stuff on the back. There's probably 3 or 4 very terse sentences that I have written with the sweating blood, you know, to try and find what do I need to tell you about this book.
Yeah.
I'd like it to be as direct as possible, but also somehow as lyrical as possible, so as to...
And enticing.
Not to reduce the book to something too simplistic. And knowing, like, just the terror of, like, and then I have to show it to the author, and they're going to be like, why have you... You took 3 weeks and you wrote this, you know? So that's not how I see
your
the
writing
book. That's
now.
Not how I see the book.
Yes.
That's right. So it's a really... I have to say, if there's one part of the job that I could guarantee would still be done well and right, but I could make go away and like with a snap of my finger, that's it right there. That and deadlines. Yeah. When I retire,
you're going to retire? That's weird.
I'm going to tell you what retirement looks like to me.
Okay.
Doing all of this still, but giving even less of a fuck about deadlines.
Okay.
Retire from me.
Right. Or what? Less of a fuck about making money?
I already don't care about that.
No, don't care about that.
No, like
as long as you can survive.
Right. So we've always had a subsistence viewpoint.
Yeah.
About.
Okay.
You know, like, and you know what? Through leaner times and better times, there's always been food on the table when I go home, and we've always managed. And you know, my children are probably, I have to consider them patrons of this enterprise because, you know, they were things that they didn't get to do. And their lives were different because of the choices that their mother and I made about what our lives are going to be. And I'm grateful to them for that's not something they've held against me. and it certainly has shaped the people they've become.
Yeah.
And but, you know, I really would rather make books I care about at the scale where I still get to control things than to sort of be pursuing this abstract idea of growth.
Yeah.
Of getting bigger, of like,
which
you know,
is
selling
this,
to
this
somebody,
kind
like
of
building,
multi,
building an asset to sell to someone else.
Yes.
I mean,
yes.
Unless your model is the family farm, where your goal is to leave the land in better shape than you showed when you showed up and to hand it on, hopefully, to someone after you. And to do good work in the meantime that nurtures you and feeds your family, but also somewhat feeds your community. And so if that is your goal, then, man, I am a tycoon.
Well, it looks like you're thriving right now. You look pretty healthy and happy.
I am. I mean, you know, there's always too much work to do. And I would say that the hardest part of this job in many ways is the responsibility that I feel to too many people. There's too many people who... whether I get something done on time or not, or how well I do something, like some outcome for them depends upon like how their career goes, hangs on my, you know, and publishing like so many things, there's no coasting. Like you're only as good as the design, this design and this book.
Yes,
like it's
got to
work every time.
Yes, but you've also got a wonderful backlist.
Oh, a good basis.
That's not
absolutely
going anywhere.
No, and we've certainly, it's something we kind of had a hunch about early on, but it's proven to be true. I mean, that every year, so many copies of Execution Poems and Wyla Falls and some of Jan Zwicky's work or Robert Bringer's work or Del Mackay's work or John Terpsch's work, you know, that as you build this sort of stable of authors, it's not like big money, but it's a starting point, you know, you're ahead of the starting line already just because those books are in print and you're able to continue to put them out to that market that wants them.
Well, yes, that, but also speaking from a collector's perspective, you know, we will look everywhere for older books and we'll find all sorts of work that you've done over the last 25 years.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose a lot of them may be trashed, but there are a lot of them that are still in circulation.
Yeah, there's enough. I think we kind of hit a sweet spot for collectors in a way, because there's enough of them out there that it's possible to find them, but not so many that they're everywhere.
No.
So there is still some search and some chase to it.
By the way, I was in Victoria recently at Russell Books.
Yeah.
They got a little, tiny little section, Gaspero Books section.
That's always heartening when you hear that, you know, both with new and antiquarian booksellers, that they that they bothered to sort of gather the books together, and because there's clearly that's how people are looking for them.
Yeah.
And from the beginning, that's been a part of what we've tried to do in terms of branding the press.
Yeah.
And I think we've been successful relative to, you know, the majority of small presses, that people actually do go look for, do you have any Gaspereau books?
Yeah. And, well, Coach House has the same appeal.
Absolutely.
No question of that.
Absolutely.
From the 60s and 70s.
But that's not how... So if you can make something that isn't immediately interchangeable with somebody else's thing, that helps a lot in terms of... particularly if you want to work at this scale. If you're chasing volume, you can be as anonymous as need be, because it's all about just moving product. If you're dependent on making a really good product and making it slowly and making it carefully, and then you really do need to cultivate...
And making it uniquely yours.
Right. And so that without it being stale, that there's always a kind of thread of, like, you see them.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh. And in the same way that I see... early Counterpoint books or North Point or I see Oberon or I see Faber or I see, you know what you're looking at, and you're delighted, and you pick it up and you see whether it's something you're interested in acquiring.
Yeah. Okay. What about end papers? What's your feeling about end papers? Blank or... Again, it depends on each book.
Very much, yeah. So, like with our trade books, we tend to do a tipped-on end sheet, which is not a proper end paper, but I like to do black paper cover that we bind the books into. So I'll put a black end sheet so that when you open the book, you get that full effect of two black.
Right.
And it's a pain. It's slow. It's a lost leader in a way. But it's important to me that it's there. On hardcover books, it's a mix. Like a printer I very much admire is Gray Zeitz at Larkspur Press in Kentucky. He's a very dear friend, and
you've done a bibliography.
We did a bibliography, absolutely, of his work. He's a guy that took letterpress tools but behaved like a small trade publisher, and has published his neighbors. You know, whether it was Wendell Berry or Guy Davenport or, you know, or all those Kentuckians you've never heard of. You know? And he's done it. He's used handset type and letterpresses and does editions, open editions of the 500 plus, you know. And so when he makes hardcover books, he simply pastes the front leaf of the book down. It's not fancy. It's it's just, he'll put some extra blanks at the end of an extra sewn signature blank so that you could cut it out and rebind it if you wanted. But it's a very basic approach, not fancy at all. And so some letterpress work I've done with end papers, that's what I've done, because it just seems to suit the no-nonsense of the project. And other times, I'm working on a book right now, which is a wood-type edition of Hopkins' Pied Beauty, which it occurred to me that would look good in 3-inch tie high wood-type. It would work with the sprung rhythm across page spreads. And it's also a way to turn a sonnet into 48 pages. But I've had end papers marbled for that book, because most of the book, the inside is this very austere, plain Gothic wood type. You know, nothing about it is fancy. You know, it's an advertising tool. You know, war, pantyhose on sale. You know, like that's what that type was for. And here it is expressing Pied Beauty by Hopkins, and I plan a pretty basic binding for it, as far as it's just going to be a plain cloth covering. But I wanted a moment of like, aha, you know. Yeah. So that has a marble end paper by this wonderful marble named Gemma Lewis in England, who was kind enough to make a special run for me.
Another reason to get that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. What about the double page spread then? How do you approach it? No, first of all, I should go to the first page of the book.
Mm-hmm.
Any thoughts on that? Like, typically there's an initial. Do you use initials or not?
We don't use initials, no.
No.
I mean, it's in this day and age, in the kind of production we're doing, it's not as important.
Okay. The classic layout?
Oh, you mean as a drop capital kind of
initial?
Yes. Oh, I thought you meant like signature initials at the bottom.
No, I mean the first letter, typically.
It's We don't often use a drop capital. Again, it depends on the project. Sometimes we have, just to be impish, because the book has a highly classical design where that makes sense. But I'm more influenced perhaps by early 20th century designers like Chicald and Updike and Rogers. So they did like those sort of fancified things to some extent. But I'm much more of a modernist, even though I have, you know, very few people look at me and go, well, he's a modernist.
Yeah, you don't look like one relative to what else is going on, but still.
And right. I had work in a show in, they were celebrating Rubens in the Baroque in Antwerp at the Plantin Moretus Museum. And I was actually the only North American trade publisher included in this show on the influence of the Baroque, which I thought really interesting because I don't think of my work as being particularly Baroque.
No. When was this?
Oh, a couple of years ago.
Okay.
Yeah. That was a great thing to be asked.
Yes.
You know how it is. You're often ignored by your own community. People far away say, who is this? Who is this person? So a scholar knew over there who was on this committee knew about our work and advocated for, like, this is a good example of someone using these classic, these Baroque traditions and reviving them in the present in a way that isn't just aping them, but is actually integrating this thinking deeply into the planning of the book and carrying it out.
Making it current.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. Repurposing an old tool.
Yeah. So the answer is...
Don't often use
not
drop
often.
Caps. Yeah, but sometimes.
What about the classic double page layout? Any thoughts on that?
It's the bedrock.
Direct you?
Yeah, it's the bedrock. And so getting those margins right.
And what's right?
Well, right is that your...
Thumbage?
Thumbage is nice when you can afford it. It depends often on the project and the budget and whether the author's writing with really long line. Like if it's a poet, like you're somewhat, the length of the line is part of it. How small can you make the type? How long is the line, you know? And you often get into those debates about, you know, I've contemplated this line a long time and I can't see why it's longer. Could you explain it to me? Mm. And if you want to defend it, I will like walk on coals to make this work for you. But if this is just like an indulgence, then we need to talk. Like this line is messing up the book.
Yes.
So I'm not afraid to have those conversations. But as far as that, the spread, a lot of the principles are just really very basic. You want that upper margin to be smaller than the lower one and the outside margins to be bigger than the inner one. And after that, it gets into just sort of tuning. And classically, you wanted the addition of the two inner margins to equal one of the outer ones. But, you know, that's not often practical. And our paperbound book doesn't open quite as wide as a hardcover book either. So you have to keep that in mind. But, you know, that's the first thing I establish. You know, there's a couple of sizes of books I like to use here. 5x8, I really love. 5.3x8.5, I really love. And I'll go off those if I need to be. But those ones feel right in hand more often. So you'd find probably 90% of our books have those proportions. The trade books.
Yeah.
And so you're starting with, is it going to be a really long book? Because if so, it should be the bigger size. If it's going to be a really short book, then it could be either. Am I going to have to set there's special challenges with the text, like are there, you know, notes, footnotes, marginal notes, you know, what you're thinking about all of these things. And then you're starting to work out that spread and you're just stepping into an average set of pages, a couple, you know, in the first chapter, you're ignoring the beginning and you're just starting to play with the margins and think about what's going to look right.
And part of that is experience, obviously.
Experience, but then every time it's
in the canon.
Well, knowing the canon, absolutely. And so, you know, what I find interesting is I will forgive other people what I would never forgive myself. So I look at something like, oh, this isn't working. I'm failing. And then I'll go look at a book by Baskerville or, you know, an older printer, even from the 20th century, you know, and a Nonsuch book, whatever. And they'll do things and I'll, when I actually measure it and look and go, oh, well, they also didn't get this exactly perfect, but it doesn't bother me. It's fine because I'm not feeling the weight of it.
Yeah, that's right. The pressure.
Right. Yeah. So you don't trust you're more critical of yourself, or you should be, I suppose. Those who aren't are making shitty books.
Well, it's like intelligent people doubt themselves. Stupid people think they know everything.
Run for president.
Yeah. Or prime minister.
Sure, fair enough. Yeah. So this comes back to what I said earlier about you're only as good as what you're doing right now. Like, you have to make it work in the present. You can't just take the thing that worked last time. And it's surprising how true this is. You can set a book in 12-point Bembo on a 15-point letting and in one text, and you can take and set up the same way with the same margins, the same line length, and it looks wrong. It's a different text. Someone's, and it's not
interesting.
And it's not just in your brain. It's the second person.
It's the words themselves.
Somebody's using more capital letters because there's more proper nouns.
Right.
Like, this has a difference in terms of how a text sets on a page. Or someone, likes a lot of, by coincidence, a lot of P's or something. Whatever it is, there's things going on. Or the paragraphs are shorter or they're longer. I mean, all of these things have an impact. So you have to learn principles. You can't learn a recipe. Mm-hmm. You have to know what coriander does.
Yeah.
But you never know how much coriander is put in exactly. you have to try.
Okay, so what's the big general, not recipe, but thought that the cook has to have before starting anything?
Well, I suppose like a cook is looking for flavor ultimately and texture. The designer is looking kind of for the same thing, right? Like that you want...
it is about experimenting.
You want to be able to, like, the eye to be easy in the text as it reads. And that's why sometimes you have to walk away and come back and just pretend that you were not there before and like you're reading it new. And as you look at a page and decide whether it's reading right,
yeah,
whether that font,
whether
that size,
good,
whether it's pop right, whether it's popping, out at you, or it's too gappy, or there's too much white, or it's too tight, or like all of these things, you're basically a page is a kind of tapestry. It's a texture that you're creating, as well as needing the reader to relax into it and forget about it.
Yeah,
and just be present in it.
It's an interesting contradiction, yeah, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Just winding down here. I want to just quickly look at the front matter. Any thoughts on the half title?
It's good to have one. I like small caps.
Okay.
Not always, but often. Yeah.
Frontispiece.
Again, it's sort of book dependent on the text. I'd like a good.
Do you have portraits of? But of authors?
We've never done that.
No.
And okay. I think was Signal doing that for a while? Signal Press?
I know. Yes, they were.
I think they were lovely. They were full bleed photos. It's a wonderful place to do an author photo for, say, a poetry book. But having watched Simon already do that, Simon Dardick.
Dardick,
yeah. I didn't copy it.
Okay. So the title page itself, what about that?
Title page I kind of do last.
Okay.
Usually even after, I maybe have started it before I do a cover or a jacket, but I inevitably go back to it after I've done a cover or a jacket and basically align it with it and make sure that it is in sympathy or in contrast or whatever I need it to be,
mm-hmm,
but that it is in conversation with it. I almost always put color on that page. Almost always. It's the best $100 I can spend in the design of a book,
because it tricks the reader
all the way through the rest of that book. You sort of, that color is in your brain,
yeah,
and you feel like you're in a book where somebody, and that's not that we haven't invested and paid attention to the other things, but when you see that color there, it says, oh, not off a photocopier, not off a Docutech or espresso machine.
Something special is what it says to
right.
me.
And it, and the cost to me is probably less. But if you asked for it, I'd charge you $100 to add that color probably on a run. It's a piece of film and a plate and the press time and a cleanup. It's money well spent.
Okay, the dedication page.
I really like dedication pages, partly because I don't like books that rush to the beginning. And so all of these things, the half title or bastard title, the title page, the frontispiece, they all kind of like ease you in. And one of the reasons we years ago removed all the copyright information from the front and tucked it at the back as like a colophon page drives some people nuts. And, you know, I've never been complained at by the Library of Canada or anybody like that. Nobody seems to care.
I always thought that the colophon was at the back anyway.
The colophon...
Maybe that's mostly fine press books, but...
Well, the colophon at the back generally was not the copyright notice, but just a notice about who printed the book and
what it was printed on, right, and what the typeface was.
So we basically put the... You know, the CIP data, yeah, and the ISBN and the, you know,
right,
please don't steal our shit stuff at the back. Because it always seemed weird to me to be entering something like a book through the broom closet.
Yeah.
You know, because that is wholly
technical broom closet stuff material that we don't really need to look at.
Well, we need, but we don't need it in that moment of...
No, not introducing... The book.
It's like it's coming into church, yeah, right? Like, yeah, you know, you come in through the front doors and you take in the atmosphere. And right, so all of these things, like that dedication, and you know,
yeah, it's like seeing a bunch of brooms and stuff in front of the church.
Yeah.
The church may be clean, but
walking past the smoking custodian, you know, or whatever. Right. Like it's just not, you know, like you don't enter a kitchen or a restaurant through the kitchen, and particularly not through past the compost bins, yeah, and all that stuff.
Yeah.
So it's the same kind of thing. I think that it helps to bring, like that color in the title page, all of that stuff,
yep,
is to sort
clean
of
it up.
Enter it, prepare you to enter this thing.
Okay. Table of contents.
My one rule about table of contents is no leader dots.
Okay.
You know, the little dot, 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 dot.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Like this is such a big thing.
Like, you don't like that?
Oh, it's just, they're ugly and unnecessary.
Okay.
And they mar our page. Like, it's just it's an instant indication of amateurism in my mind. Well, anytime I see
that's harsh.
I'm good with it. There's just so many other ways to present. You're presenting, you know, a map, essentially, and with finding aids.
Yeah.
And there's so many ways to do that are just less ugly. Okay. And, I sometimes enjoy setting, and I do it all. I don't use any of the special tools. I build them from scratch. And again, late in the job, so that everything's, you know, the chapters are actually, if you've edited a chapter title, that's going to be right in both places.
That's right. Yes. Yeah.
But I take as much joy out of designing that page or a good index as I do from the actual title page, say.
Forgot the epigraph. Any thoughts on that?
Epigraphs are overused. I like them at the beginning of books. Actually, they make sense to me there.
Mm-hmm.
Where I take issue often is poets who have epigraphs in every second poem is to start the poem. And my absolutely brutal line that I almost never use is, why do you want someone else to have written the best line in this poem?
Yeah, or the book. Why do you want the reader to remember someone else?
You know, in the best instances, good epigraph sets the table, you know, makes a link forward or backwards, you know.
Unless
it can be very useful, but in moderation.
Useful in the sense that if this book was instigated by a relationship with that.
Right.
Otherwise.
Or if they're hinting at a more lyrical or abstract element that is not necessarily immediately
evident
in the text, that can be a very useful device.
Yeah.
But when you start plunking it at the top of every poem or every chapter or section or whatever, it becomes this kind of shortcut, as opposed it becomes Hallmark cardy. It's a way out of doing the work. Just do the work. Don't start with their image to get me in a good mood. Just do the work.
Yes and no. I mean, one of my favorite Canadian books of poetry of all time is Michael Lister's Bloom.
Mm-hmm.
And he does a lot of that.
He does. Probably too much.
I disagree.
I'm okay with my assertion.
No.
But all assertions are limited in their application. So so recognizing a shortcoming or a potential weakness in the epigraph is different than a prohibition, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It sort of like amps up your sense of responsibility to not screw it up, because you're aware that it is entirely possible to screw it up.
Yeah.
And to have all of these sort of lame duck epigrams all over the place.
Although funny, I mean, I always thought an epigraph was just at the front of the book. You're using it.
I guess I'm using it more. Because every poem is like a book in a sense, in terms of its sort of interior logic. And so the fact that authors are starting with the title and then a quotation from someone else, they're essentially using it as a a junior scale epigraph, I suppose.
Okay.
So maybe there is an actual fancy ass word that is the right word for that, that neither you or I in our years of activity,
in our erudition,
have not stumbled across, but do feel the end when you find it.
Okay. Now quickly here, foreword, preface, acknowledgements, introduction, what thoughts do you have on those, if any?
Again, it's so dependent on, like, a really...
Design-wise, I'm talking
about. Oh, design-wise.
Yeah.
Yeah, design-wise. So once you get into things like that, you're dealing largely with, you know, how to deal with a title, how to deal with an opening line, you know, how much of a depth to leave, whether you leave any depth. Like, you know, I find, I rub my hands together with glee when I get a manuscript where I can legitimately do something strange without it being forced. So what I mean by that is that you get a book of poems and all the poems are of a uniform length and they're all, you know, the lines are pretty uniform and you go, I can bottom align all of these poems, you know, to
yes,
the bottom, which yes. is not, a, you know, none of them run over to a second page. So suddenly you are, there's a whole new box of tools that you need to say, does it make sense? Or am I just like having a piss here?
Yeah.
Like, you know?
Yeah,
so,
I was going to say farting around.
Yeah. Yeah. So, so you get to, sometimes you get to indulge something different when the text presents the opportunity
yeah.
and when it serves the text, but it has to do both.
Yeah. Looking at it, it can't confuse you or like as a reader, you do question why the design is different than you might normally expect. That's going to come up. So you as a designer want to make sure that's there's a good reason
that's
that
right.
you did that.
Yeah. And we often, I sort of like, you know, vent that tendency in more experimental things like chapbooks or letterpress pieces. Like,
oh, yeah, okay.
And in a trade book, I mostly mind my own business and just keep to the main, you know, the main classical approaches to things. But one of the things when it comes to beginnings of chapters and such, I really like, basically you have to decide centered or not centered, and that has an impact on everything throughout the rest of the book.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, if you have subheadings, are they long? Are they more than one line? You know, you've got to look at those elements and then make decisions that impact what seem like aesthetic decisions actually come back to these, what is possible with what has to happen here. I really love the Pilcrow.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
So the paragraph marker.
Yeah, I love it. Yeah.
And so I almost, so you know how you do things, well, how I have done things for years and thought, yep, this territory, like I'm trapping beaver and soon more people will be here trapping beaver and there won't be as much beaver for me anymore. But there's been a number of things in terms of design and production that I thought, yep, we'll have a few years and then other people will go, look how easy it is to do this right or to do this better. And then they'll join me here on this side of the river and it'll just be, you know, it'd be nice to have
company. There'll be no beaver.
Yeah, yeah. But it'll just be not my own domain. But the Pilcrow, I can't think anyone else using the Pilcrow in any meaningful way. I mean, you know, Bringhurst uses it once in a while for some things, but as a sort of pretty steady in most books device for marking the beginnings of sections, marking the beginnings of chapters, it's just not, like, nobody's using it.
Well, that's good. That's good.
But
I used it on one of my websites.
Yeah.
But that's...
Yeah. But like, again, I'm talking in broad terms, not, it's just generally not, it's a thing I discovered and thought, holy cow, how come no one is using this?
Right.
And then as I went forward and keep looking over my shoulder, I'm walking down that path alone. So you think about something practical, like when you've got a text that has a lot of short section breaks and you need a little gap, you know, but those gaps are awkward for getting good balanced pages. And they often appear at the bottom of a page and you're not necessarily sure that, you know, so often the sort of three asterisks would be used or that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But they take up a lot of space. So instead of having, say, one blank line or two blank lines and then a new paragraph, you have to have a blank line and a set of asterisks, another blank. Well, that's three lines. So if you have a lot of these throughout a book and you say, we're going to do one blank line, and a Pilcrow at the beginning of the next paragraph and maybe a couple of capitals or wording in small caps, and that will signal enough. Suddenly you have a much less problematic thing when it comes to the breaking of pages.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not, again, it's somewhat aesthetic, but it's also about how to get efficiency in a complicated text.
From the perspective of just doing the typesetting.
A page count.
Yeah.
Right? That's economics, right?
Yes.
So yeah. It looks like, Andrew really likes the Pilgrim, but actually, I like things not being, two sections longer than they need to be, right?
Yes.
So it's a mix of these.
And things. Again, that points to, this knowledge, design, and production.
Right, right.
What about Roman numerals for the pages at the front end of the book?
In general, I use Roman numerals very little. I sometimes, for a while, I used them on title pages just because it was fun and obscure.
Yeah.
But generally speaking, in terms of using them to number sections or poems, within a text, I almost always try to push an author towards, Arabic numerals because we're just not, it's just not part of our cultural moment, Roman numerals. That's not what we do.
Yeah, but there's nothing wrong with standing out and following
tradition.
None
of it's impractical. Like, so if there's like 1, 2, and 3, everyone can follow that. But if it gets up to 25 or 27 or 80.
Typically it's just in the introductory part
of
the book.
So I'll get to that in a second. Yeah. I mean more generally, like if someone's numbered like 80 poems and they want these Roman numerals, I would say, what are you doing? Do you really want to be misunderstood that badly? But when it comes in the prelims using Romans, I see it as a largely antiquated practice that doesn't have a practical application anymore.
Okay.
Because often, you would have the text and it would be ready and you would start and you'd start setting page one and you'd number those pages as you'd set them, right?
Right.
But Erasmus was still writing the foreword.
Well, that's
so the
thing,
prelims
though,
would have their own
system. Set. Yeah, because you could add to it without screwing up the other pagination.
Right, exactly. So it became this sort of, had this function. And you sometimes see it in reprinted books where a new apparatus has been added. In a situation like that, there's a logic to it that merits considering it. There are perhaps other better solutions. But as a kind of like default habit of like, if there's a foreword, the page number should only start on the first page of the actual text. I mean, that's nonsense. If there's not apparatus, because it's complicated, why would you complicate it? With our trade books, we start numbering on the very first sheet of the very first press sheet. So
the first part of the
not
text.
On page one of the text, but on when I count numbers, I count them from, when you take that first octaval press sheet and you fold it and there's a blank sheet on the front, that's page one.
But you don't put one on it, do you?
You don't.
Then you start it at 3 or 5 or 7, depending on where
maybe
the text
that's
starts.
Right. The first page of the text or the introduction or whatever might be page 7 or something, right? And that, in that context, where that end sheet is never a waste sheet or bound, it's just like there, it makes sense. So we, from a trade production standpoint, have always done that, even though it's not old practice, right? Where it got me into trouble for the first time is when I used my friend Gray Zeit's idea of like using that first sheet as your paste down. And so when I was doing his bibliography, I was like, the page numbers were all wonky. And I kept saying, well, just count every page that went through the sheet, through the press. Like that's just count them all, whether they're blank or they're at the beginning or the end or whatever. And he was having trouble with this and I couldn't figure out why. Well, that's why, because he was pasting what would be the literal page one and the literal page 80 down.
Yes.
So they were gone. And now page 3 is page one. I made a book that way and I thought, oh God, of course. So now when I do a letterpress book, I always start the page numbering on the first page of the text.
Yes.
But when I do a trade book, I go with the other one. So
Just
a minute, like 3 people are going to understand the explanation, but they're going to laugh.
Yeah, good. Okay, what about where you put the number? Again, it's probably a function of the specific book itself, but do you tend to put the number, at the top right-hand corner, or do you go right center at the bottom?
Again, it's dependent on the broader design, whether you're centering or not centering, your headings and so on. But I have to say, of all of the things, I can't remember who it was. There was a British designer who once in a letter to an American designer made in the 20s or 30s made fun of the extent to which American book designers thought novelty, design was simply moving the folio around to different locations.
Yeah.
that was all that they did with change in design. Mm. And from the moment I read that, I felt keenly. I mean, it's so true. It's I hate folios. Of all the things that give me the most angst in designing a book, I hate figuring out where to put the numbers, page numbers, in a way that doesn't say, hey, look at me, or is a problem. If you have any kind of a book with any kind of complexity, which are the fun ones to set, you have to find a place where it works in all of the iterations of the various parts of the book. Or you have to make exceptions and move it. You know, that's the other thing is, and that's something I definitely learned from Bringhurst, from watching his design. You know, not something he wrote or said, but looking at a lot of his early books he designed, the thing that I learned was the judicious exception. Mm-hmm. Places you would drop a folio just because it made sense for some other quietly you could sneak an extra line in the page and make avoid an awkward break, but you had to lose the folio to do it. And you just lose the folio and you don't tell anybody about it.
And sorry, what do you mean by that?
Folio is the page number, right?
Yeah.
So if you...
So in other words, you just don't put the number on the page.
You just make it disappear. For one page, it's gone.
Right. So but, one person...
But you know that that page is 146, yes. And you know that the page following is 148. Like, yes. There's not a problem,
no,
right?
No.
So, but, you know, or, you know, if you have it, if you're doing them in the margin and you suddenly have a long line that has to cheat and come out of the normal margin, and the folio is in the way, well, it disappears. Like,
yeah.
So... Robert learned early, and I learned early by watching him, that design is not about making a rule and then never bending that rule. It is about absolutely knowing where to quietly make these exceptions. And that makes a very robust design. Because if you were trying to design something that will work for, you know, particularly a complex book, a complex piece of prose with lots of apparatus and notes, and you're trying to design something that will work in every possible iteration, you'll go mad. You have to find the kind of medium, the thing that is the best thing, and then massage these exceptions and problems. And that's where I think, you know, you can spot the really, it's not the leaders on the table of contents so much. That was a cheap shot. But it's in these things, you know, the ability to be elastic in the design in a way that no one notices, but works. That's where you can tell the good designers who love their work versus those who are just hammering it out. And the folio is often the culprit.
Well, we start looking for that. Okay.
And if you have a good proofreader, they always say, there is no page number on this page. And then you ignore them.
then you say to them, listen, that's good book design.
That's right.
So back of the book, the appendix or addendum, same kind
of
comments.
Yeah, same kind of comments.
Glossary, bibliography. And the colophon.
Yeah, I like colophons when I can do them. At the very least,
I love reading.
I make sure there's something.
They're poetry.
I always, in our trade books, I always make sure that at least the typeface and it is named, and that Gary and I are named and as the overseers of the work. But we don't tend to do too elaborate. And sometimes I'll do a more length colophon if I'm describing it, the type, you know, or something. If I've got room. So often these kinds of things, you're expanding and contracting, you know, end material, because you're like, if I take this out, I'll fit in 9 signatures, not 10, and no one will miss it. But sometimes it's like you're 3 or 4 or 5 pages over and you've got, you know, still more of the 16 pages to fill up. And so you balance whites in the front and the back as best you can, and you break something out, you add a note in the type, or you add, it's a trick, it's an optical illusion to make the book look balanced. So you don't always do it. And I've been in situations, I was in one recently where an author was quite insistent that, he really, really wanted one of those wonderful notes in the type, and that, like, that book was jammed up against, it was a too long book, and it was jammed up against the end of a section. It's like, there's no way I'm going to add a note to the type. This book is too long.
Yeah.
So I had to find a diplomatic and quiet way to get around it.
Okay, finally, speaking of diplomatic and quiet, we hear a lot about you. We don't hear that much about Gary. Maybe you could just tell me a bit about it. I know nothing about him.
So. The company is us. Yeah.
Right.
There would be no Gaspero without the two of us. And Gary is, Updike had his partner. What was his name? Bianchi or something? I can't remember. Who was it?
That's
printer.
The thing. Yeah.
Yeah.
Don't know.
But, right. Nobody remembers him.
Right.
But, you know, he ran the damn shop for the most part. He kept things going. And it was Updike who wrote things and did the design, and the clients knew Updike. But it was his partner, John, who kept this trade running. He runs the offset shop and the trade bindery. So when I'm done editing and designing a book, hands off to Gary and the way he runs with that. And I'm, you know, still in the mix, but it's I've left it to him, and I move on and do the jacket on the letterpress or whatever. Gary also, you know, manages the sales and the finances and all that side of it. Keeps all of our tech running.
That's,
you know,
a lot.
Runs press, yeah, when needed. Runs, keeps the equipment running. You know, like, so there's a lot of overlap between some of the things we do and then other areas. Like, I haven't.
And you get along.
Yes. Yeah.
Obviously.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, we are different, very different people in some ways, and yet our values are well aligned. And there's been rough moments, you know, throughout the, you know, there was a period, for example, you know, where Gary's marriage fell apart. It had implications for the press, inevitably. And that was a pretty rough time for us as partners. But actually, the part of it that was rough was really pretty short. It was, you know, evident to me that I didn't want to do this unless I was doing it with Gary. Mm. And so we were going to figure it out. And we did. Yeah, so it's funny. He's not someone who, on a local level, he takes a lot of pride in owning the business, and you can see it. And he, in terms of how he presents himself to other people, how he talks about the business, how he, on the sort of bigger scale of, like, you know, being interviewed or writing a piece on something, he's just less interested.
That's good that you're, again, you compliment each other.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. And we've always worked in consensus. We've always managed, through even the toughest things, to talk and to listen and to come around to a decision that we both then got behind.
Mm-hmm.
And that has always been the case. And I'm grateful for that, because that's not how a lot of partnerships go. And, you know, the biggest difference, I think, between Gary and I is on that creative side, perhaps. And it's not that Gary has a lot of things that he doesn't hear that are creative in a broader sense. But I come to work every day, and I'm, like, working on things that I originate, that I've selected the work, or I have created the work, and I'm, you know, carrying it out. And when it comes to the letterpress projects, even, I can't work fast enough to keep up with the things I want to do. When Gary comes to work in the morning, the nature of his part of the job is different in that he is executing something that's requested. It's a print job with a client who wants, mm-hmm, wants 500 of this, and he doesn't matter to him whether that's the right color for it. That's the color they want, you know. So he, right? So he's, or and even with me, when I hand him a job, those things are determined already.
Yeah.
And he's, you know, not. He and I talk about what books we're going to do. When I'm signing books, he's in, you know, he's not often read them in advance, but we're talking about it. But so that's I think the biggest difference in terms of our involvement, and really the only fundamental difference in terms of our involvement.
So you both believe that paying attention is important.
Yeah, and I don't know whether Gary, had he not bumped into me, whether he would have articulated these things in any kind of way similar. I don't know. It's hard to say. But I think that when I articulate the ideas, he recognizes in it the values that he holds, right, and sees those values voiced. And I know that because I've watched Gary and his other involvements in the community. You know, he's involved in his church, and he's involved at the food bank, and he's involved in various other, you know, volunteer organizations around the community. And I watch him living those things out in the way he is, the person that he is. And so it's not a hard sell for me to go to him and say, this is more important than that, because he's already there. Mm-hmm. Though he would not stand up on a soapbox like me and wave his arms and rant, you know, for an hour about this is better than that, or we must do this and we shouldn't do that. Where I'm much more prone to expressing those opinions and the hope that it helps.
Okay. Finally, we shit on presidents and prime ministers and people yeah, who run for them. I've been feeling bad about that ever since we said that.
It was a throwaway line, Nigel.
It was, but it kind of goes in the face of paying attention to the point of getting involved. And, I mean, we can pay attention, but if we don't do anything, if we don't, we can talk, you know, we can have a conversation about things that are upsetting us, and I can put it on a podcast, but it's not the same as actually getting involved, for example, in the election or running for office. I'm going on here a bit, but I'll edit this.
No, don't.
What I want to say is the elite do run this world. And if democracy is worth anything, then people actually have to get involved.
Absolutely.
And vote for the right people that will actually, for example, redistribute income, at least to the point where people aren't starving on the street in our society.
I think that when a publisher is doing their job, that they are contributing to that community activity of participating in all of the elements of our community, including the political elements, whether it's partisan or not. One of the involvements I've had in my community for the last couple of decades or so has been, I've been very involved with municipal politics, but not in a way that's visible. I came into this largely out of a literary background and a journalism background. And so some of my earliest gigs as a journalist were West Carleton Township. Right. Town meetings before they were amalgamated into the greater Ottawa, you know, as the one reporter in the room while the five contractors who happened to be counselors around the table changed the rules to their benefit, you know. So it's a way of thinking about the world and engaging the world, journalism, that is deeply rooted in me. I started my first newspaper in my teens. And so while I've ended up in this, what looks like an isolationist sort of corner of the literary endeavor, which is poetry, nothing could be further from the truth. I see the books that we make as providing sort of the nutrients needed to grow a healthy community, to foster the kind of critical thinking, the kind of sense of responsibility that brings people out to vote thoughtfully, that allows people to question, you know, development agreements, you know, to untangle land use bylaws, you know, and to think about what kind of communities they want to live in and how to take care of each other and not to get steamrolled over by simply moneyed interest all the time. Most people don't think about that stuff and say, oh, where you start is with poetry. But in a lot of ways, it is where you start. And so the chair you're sitting in has very often been sat in by people thinking about running for office, people coming just to talk about
making a difference,
about
making
the values,
some change.
Yeah, about the values. And that is a role that in our own ways, Gary and I both take very seriously, is that particularly as a somewhat public funded enterprise here. I mean, we draw a fair amount of money down from the Canada Council every year.
Yeah.
And so I view myself as actually a public servant, except without the pension. And,
That's your backlist.
I'm glad that you value my backlist.
Well, that's the problem, though. A lot of it, you don't see any of that money because it's secondhand.
But I view my responsibility is to be available and to be present and thinking and engaged. And so the number of people, not just students coming through wanting to be writers, there's no end of those. And people want to be book designers, there's no end of those. And that's great. And you do what you can to kind of like just tempt them out of the safety of their ideas to try something and to take a risk. But there's this other sort of class of people that you know, we've made ourselves available to, who are people who are trying to understand the community and how to be in it and how to function in it and how to have a positive influence on it. And I put a lot of time in it at council meetings, sitting quietly, good, taking notes, you know, so that I can be that help, so that I can say to the person that has missed, you know, has come when it's two steps too late and things are already out of hand and they're angry and they're just yelling at people.
Yeah.
To be able to say, why don't you come have a chat and to talk about, well, you got to build support.
Well, and you're giving them a voice. It may not be a loud voice, but you're allowing them to air their voice in a beautiful format.
Well, and to try to help them to understand, I believe in the process. Mm. I believe in justice. I believe in the communities that we can have if we choose to have them. And as much as moneyed interests do run the show, as you say, they don't run it well without our dollars. And so the choices that we make as citizens and as consumers have a huge impact on how easy that goes for them and on how healthy our communities will be. So if we can spend a dollar with someone who we know shares our values and also shares our fate in our own community, and we're never going to, like, you know, no one's going to start manufacturing cars in Kentville. It's not going to happen.
No.
But I can buy bacon from someone that raised a hog here, right? Like, it. So there's things you can do to strengthen your community and to diminish the kind of hold that those that would have unfair and outsized influence wield. But and it all starts again with showing up, paying attention,
yeah,
and finding how to think and how to talk about these things to each other. And mm-hmm, that's what literature ultimately is about. It's a kind of political act without the bullhorn and the yelling. I don't want to go hard on Joe Biden or
no,
Trudeau or anyone else. It's a hard job. And what worries me is that we can't attract better people sometimes. And again, that's not to say that they're not good people, but I do worry that we can't attract the range of people and the range of thinking that we need. Our biggest failure is actually not economic. Usually it's one of imagination, being able to see the way forward and to believe that we can take it. That's where the failure often is. But now I'm just preaching.
Well, that's your Baptist upbringing.
That's my Baptist upbringing, Dave. Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you.
Oh, listen, it was a pleasure to see you.
Andrew Steeves is the co-founder of Gaspro Press, based in Kentville, Nova Scotia.
No, I am from New Brunswick. Yeah, yeah.
That's huge.
It's okay. Same watershed.
Kentville, Nova Scotia. And your website is?
Just gaspro.com. And we're on Instagram. It's a good place to see what we're up to.
Very good. Thanks again.
Yeah, great.